Imagine walking into a movie theater. You sit down with your popcorn, the lights dim, and those heavy velvet curtains pull back.
Right, the classic opening experience.
Exactly. And the screen flickers to life. But instead of a 2-hour film, you just get a black screen with the title card in stark white text.
Oh, wow. Just the
It's
title.
just the title, and then the lights just come back up. The projectionist literally tells you to go home.
I mean, that would be incredibly jarring.
Yeah, on one hand, you'd feel completely cheated, right? Because you bought a ticket for a narrative, a whole journey.
You want the whole story.
Right. But on the other hand, if you were forced to sit in that theater for an hour, staring at just those few words, you would start to analyze them in a way you never, like, ever would have
You'd
otherwise.
really have to hyper-focus on them.
Exactly. You would start to ask, well, why these specific words? What is the director promising me with this exact phrasing? And that is exactly the scenario we are dealing with today on this deep dive.
It's so true. It forces a kind of hyper-focused analytical isolation.
It really does.
Because normally, when we sit down to analyze a text, whether it's, a sprawling piece of investigative journalism or a complex scientific paper, we rely on volume.
Right, we want the mass of data.
Exactly. We look for cross-references, thematic repetition, the slow build of an argument over hundreds of pages. We basically find comfort in the sheer mass of the data.
It's like archaeology, You want to see the sprawling footprint of the ancient city on the ground penetrating
That's a
radar.
great way to put it.
You want the historian to point at the screen and say, "There it is, years of material to dig through."
But today, our radar is essentially pointing at, like, a single isolated brick in the middle of a desert.
Just one brick.
Yeah, because the source material we've been handed for this deep dive is an excerpt, but the excerpt consists entirely of a single title.
Five words.
Right, five words. Index funds explained for beginners. That is the totality of our document.
And I'll admit, when I first saw the source deck, my initial reaction was, what are we supposed to do with this?
Yeah, it's pretty sparse.
We are so used to swimming in data. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized that this is actually the ultimate test of deconstruction.
Because a title isn't just a label, right?
Exactly. It's not just slapped on a book as an afterthought. It is the very first point of contact.
It is the absolute distillation of the author's intent. In many ways, the shorter the text, the heavier the burden placed on every individual syllable.
Oh, that's a really good point. Every syllable has to pull its weight.
Right. When an author only has five words to capture an audience, to, convey a complex financial mechanism, and to disarm the reader's natural anxieties, those five words have to work incredibly hard.
So here is our blueprint for this deep dive. For you, the listener, who likely already has a firm grasp on modern finance, we aren't going to spend the next hour treating you like you don't know what an index fund is.
Oh, that wouldn't be very useful for you.
Right. Instead, we are going to use this five-word excerpt as a launch pad to deconstruct the psychology of financial communication.
We're going to unpack the architecture of this phrase, basically.
Exactly. We want to understand how the financial industry attempts to bridge the gap between complex algorithmic realities and, well, the everyday consumer.
So we'll examine the subject, index funds, and why that specific terminology creates such a massive institutional barrier.
It's a huge
It
barrier.
really is. And then we'll look at the action explained to understand the epistemology of how we actually acquire complex knowledge versus, merely receiving data.
The difference between being told and being taught.
Right. And finally, we will analyze the intended audience for beginners to explore the sociology of expertise and the ego of the learner.
So let's jump right into the meta-analysis of the excerpt itself. Because before we even look at the words index funds, we have to grapple with the context.
The context is everything here.
It is. The source is explicitly framed as an excerpt from Index Funds Explained for Beginners. So the excerpt of the text literally is the title of the text.
Which introduces the concept of the promise of the premise.
Okay, unpack that for me. What does that mean?
Well, in the publishing world, or in adult education, essentially any form of structured communication, a title serves as a legally binding emotional contract with the reader.
And emotional contracts. I like
Yeah.
that.
By presenting only the title as the excerpt, we are forced to examine the pure blueprint of the author's intent before any actual instruction even begins.
I have to push back on that framing right out of the gate, though.
Oh, really? How come?
An emotional contract. I mean, isn't that giving a bit too much credit to what is, in all likelihood, just SEO optimization?
You think it's just about search engines?
Let's be real. if I'm writing a book or an article about finance in the digital age, I'm not agonizing over an emotional contract. I'm looking at search volume.
Right. The Google keywords.
Exactly. People type index funds explained for beginners into search engines. So that becomes the title. It's a cynical mechanism, not a psychological promise.
I wouldn't call it purely cynical, though, even if it is driven by search algorithms. No, because let's look at why those algorithms prioritize that specific string of words in the first place. Algorithms reflect human behavioral psychology at scale.
Okay, I'm listening.
If millions of people are typing that exact phrase into a search bar, it reveals a collective structural anxiety.
So the algorithm is just highlighting what we're already worried about.
Exactly. The algorithmic optimization is just a mirror reflecting the reader's need for a specific type of emotional assurance. The contract still exists, even if, you know, a machine basically facilitated the matchmaking.
Okay, I see your point. The algorithm is just the middleman here.
Right. It's just connecting the anxiety to the solution.
But let's dig into that structural anxiety. When you talk about this contract setting expectations, how does that actually manifest in the brain of someone about to read the text?
Well, it's known as the framing effect. It's particularly prevalent in the theory of adult education, or andragogy.
Andragogy, okay.
Yeah, unlike children who generally just absorb information because an authority figure tells them they must, adults are highly pragmatic learners.
Mm. Right, we need a reason to care.
Exactly. An adult needs to know the why before they care about the what. When an adult reads a title, their brain instantly begins building cognitive scaffolding.
It's building a framework for the information.
It starts opening certain mental folders and aggressively closing others.
So if the title is intimidating, the brain just puts up defensive walls.
Precisely. If the title suggests a high cognitive load, the reader's stress response can actually trigger, inhibiting their ability to absorb the subsequent material.
Wait, really? It actually triggers a physiological stress response?
Yes. Cortisol levels can actually spike if the framing is too overwhelming. Conversely, if the title is welcoming and highly structured, the brain relaxes into a state of receptivity.
It's like taking a deep breath before you start reading.
Exactly. The author of our excerpt understands that before they can explain the mechanics of passive market tracking, they first have to manage the reader's cortisol levels.
Which transitions us perfectly into the actual construction of this specific contract, because the author has a massive hill to climb based purely on the subject matter.
The subject is a big hurdle.
The primary focus of the text is index funds.
The noun phrase that really anchors the entire excerpt.
Right. Now, for our listeners, we know the mechanics here. We know that an index fund is a type of mutual fund or exchange-traded fund with a portfolio constructed to match or track the components of a financial market index, like the S&P 500.
Right. We understand the actual vehicle.
We know it's the vehicle of passive investing, but I want to divorce the term from our inherent financial literacy for a moment.
Okay, let's step back on the finance.
Let's look at the linguistics of how the industry chose to name this revolutionary financial vehicle. If we separate this from finance completely, what does the word index evoke for you?
Fundamentally, it evokes order.
Order. Okay.
Yeah, it suggests tracking, categorization, and comprehensiveness. An index doesn't generate new information. It organizes existing information so it can be navigated.
Right. I think of the pages at the very back of a massive, dusty encyclopedia.
Exactly. The index at the back.
Or a card catalog in an old library. Or a metal filing cabinet. It feels incredibly clinical. It's dry.
That clinical nature is actually baked into its etymology.
Oh, really? What's the root?
The Latin root, indicare, literally means to point out or to indicate.
To indicate. That makes sense.
So the word index introduces a sense of vastness, all the stocks in a market, but a vastness that has been mathematically or alphabetically subdued.
Subdued, like it's been tamed.
Right. It is inherently rigid. It removes the human element entirely from the equation.
And then you pair it with the second word, funds. Now, I hear the word funds in isolation. I immediately think of a pool of money.
A collection of resources.
Like a rainy day fund in a glass jar on the fridge. Or a local telethon raising funds for a charity. It implies a collective pooling of resources.
But it also carries a significant psychological weight, especially in a professional context.
How so?
It implies capitalization. It implies that something of deep, tangible value is being stored, guarded, or put at stake.
Right. It's not just loose change. It's serious.
Exactly. When you merge those two concepts, the rigid mathematical pointing of an index and the high-stakes resource pooling of a fund, you create a highly specific and, frankly, somewhat alienating mental image for the uninitiated.
It sounds like a fortress. Index funds.
It really does.
It sounds like an abstraction that is guarded by math.
It sounds incredibly institutional.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great irony of the term, honestly.
Why is it ironic?
Because John Bogle, when he essentially pioneered the first index investment trust for retail investors back in the 1970s, he was doing something radically populist.
He was trying to open the doors for everyone.
Exactly. He was democratizing investing. He was taking the power away from the high-priced, active Wall Street managers who were just eating up everyday investors' returns with massive fees.
Right. The guys in the suits taking their huge cut.
And he was offering a way for the average person to just own a slice of the entire market at a fraction of the cost. The concept is profoundly egalitarian.
But the name he gave it, or, you know, the name the industry settled on, sounds completely elitist.
It does. It really does.
It's a populist tool wrapped in an exclusionary label. I mean, think about it. If you are walking down the street and someone yells, "Hey, want to talk about the democratized pooling of market resources?" You might be intrigued.
You'd at least stop and listen.
But if they yell, "Hey, want to talk about index funds?" Your immediate reaction is going to be a defensive posture.
You just keep walking.
Exactly. You think, "I don't have the math degree for this," or, "I don't wear a Patagonia fleece vest to work. This isn't for me."
This highlights a crucial observation about how industries develop terminology.
How so?
Well, any specialized field, whether it's finance, medicine, corporate law, or even software engineering, develops hyper-efficient language to communicate internally.
Right, to save time among peers.
Index funds is a brilliantly efficient label for people who already understand the underlying mechanics of market capitalization and passive tracking.
It works great for the insiders.
But for the outside world, that efficiency acts as a wall. The compression of complex ideas into short jargon inherently creates an accidental barrier to entry.
But is it entirely accidental?
You think it's deliberate?
I'm going to challenge that, because the financial industry has a long documented history of using complexity as a moat.
A moat to protect their business models.
Exactly. If the average consumer understands exactly how simple an index fund is, that it literally just passively buys the list of companies and sits there, they won't pay a financial advisor a 1% asset under management fee.
That's a very fair point.
The jargon serves a protective purpose for the industry's profit margins. Doesn't the phrase index fund serve the industry better when it sounds intimidating?
That is a very fair critique of the financial sector at large. The complexity moat is a real phenomenon.
They want you to think it's too hard to do yourself.
Active managers historically relied on the perception that investing was too labyrinthine for the layman. However, the specific author of our excerpt is attempting to subvert that moat.
They're trying to cross the moat.
That's the tension in the text. The author has chosen a subject, index funds, that inherently alienates the exact person they're trying to reach, whether that alienation is a byproduct of linguistic efficiency or a deliberate industry moat.
They have built a wall of abstraction in the first two words.
Which means they immediately have to deploy a linguistic countermeasure to bring that wall down.
Right, because the subject matter sounds abstract and potentially intimidating, the title has to offer a bridge.
And that bridge is the action of this text.
And that bridge is the single word, explained.
The pivot point of the excerpt. It's the promise of transformation.
This is where the mechanics of how we learn really come into play. I want to draw a really sharp distinction here, because I think in our daily lives, we use words like tell and explain interchangeably.
We do use them like they mean the same thing.
But they are fundamentally different cognitive processes. There is a massive difference between being told a fact and having a system explained to you.
Let's unpack that distinction. How are you defining the boundary between the two?
Okay, well, let's step outside of finance for a second. I can be told that the sky is blue.
Sure.
I can memorize that fact. If a teacher asks me what color the sky is, I can regurgitate the word blue. Great. I have acquired data.
But you don't know why.
Exactly. I have absolutely zero underlying comprehension of the physical world.
You possess knowledge that a thing is true, but not knowledge of how it is true.
Exactly. Having it explained to me requires an entirely different journey. It requires someone taking me by the hand and walking me through the mechanics of light refraction.
Right. They have to build a model for you.
They have to introduce the concept of the Earth's atmosphere, the different wavelengths of solar radiation, and how the human eye perceives the scattering of those specific shorter wavelengths.
Rayleigh scattering.
Yes. Being told is just receiving a sealed package and putting it on a shelf. being explained to is unpacking the box together, taking the machinery apart, and seeing how the gears actually interlock.
That analogy perfectly illustrates the epistemology at work in this title.
How does it connect back to our five words?
Well, the word explained implies a causal narrative. It promises the reader that they will not just be handed a list of ticker symbols or historical return rates.
They aren't just getting data points.
They will be guided through the machinery of the market. Yep. And from a psychological standpoint, using the word explained in a title is arguably the most empathetic act an author can perform in an educational context.
I understand the promise of the narrative, but where does empathy factor into it?
Because using the word explained is a tacit admission by the author that the topic is inherently dense, complex, or frequently misunderstood.
Oh, I see. It's an acknowledgement of the difficulty.
Right. If I write a manual on how to drink a glass of water, I don't title it Drinking Water Explained.
No, because it doesn't need explaining.
The act is universally understood. It requires no cognitive unpacking. But by adding explained to index funds, the author is signaling a deep empathy to the reader.
They are saying, I know the first two words of this title probably made you anxious.
Exactly. I know this industry has built a mode of jargon. I validate your confusion.
It's an active validation of the reader's prior ignorance. It removes the stigma from not knowing.
It takes the pressure off.
It's saying, it is entirely reasonable that you don't know this because it literally requires a guide to get through it.
Precisely. It removes shame from the learning equation. An explanation is a deeply relational dynamic. As you noted with the sky analogy, you cannot explain something to a brick wall.
Right. It has to be a two-way street.
True explanation requires what psychologists call a theory of mind.
A theory of mind. Okay, what is that?
The explainer must actively model the mind of the listener. They must be able to hypothesize where the specific gaps in the reader's knowledge are and carefully build cognitive bridges across those exact gaps.
Which requires a tremendous amount of vulnerability on both sides of the transaction.
It really does.
The expert, the guide, has to step down from their pedestal, abandon their hyper-efficient industry jargon, and actively remember what it felt like to not know how the system worked.
And that is incredibly hard to do.
That curse of knowledge is so hard to break. Once you understand a concept, it is incredibly difficult to imagine the mind of someone who doesn't.
And on the flip side, the listener, the reader holding the book, has to be willing to engage in the vulnerability of admitting a deficit.
Which is terrifying for a lot of adults.
In our modern, hyper-competitive, white-collar world, admitting a knowledge deficit can feel incredibly dangerous.
Especially when the topic is inexorably linked to resources, security, and money.
We see this constantly in corporate culture.
Oh, all the time. The sociology of the workplace basically demands that we pretend to know things we don't.
It's a survival tactic.
Think about how many times people nod along in a meeting when terms like EBITDA or capital expenditure or market capitalization are thrown around.
Everyone is just nodding very seriously.
People are terrified of looking foolish, so they engage in the classic maneuver. Nod, smile, and secretly Google the term under the conference table on their phone.
We've all been there.
We've all been in a situation where someone casually drops a financial term and we just build a facade of comprehension.
This five-word excerpt is an explicit invitation to drop that facade. It is a designated safe zone.
A safe zone. I like that.
By placing explained directly adjacent to the institutional jargon of index funds, the author is promising to do the heavy lifting of translation.
They are the ones doing the work.
They are promising to take the abstract mechanics of passive tracking and convert them into the vernacular of the everyday person.
But here is a question for you. When we demand that things be explained, particularly in the realm of complex finance, are we inherently demanding that they be watered down?
The simplification debate.
Is there a danger that in translating the complex algorithmic reality of modern ETF trading into a digestible narrative, the author is actually providing a cartoon version of reality?
It's a valid concern.
Like, if I explain quantum mechanics using billiard balls, I've made it understandable, but I've also made it fundamentally inaccurate.
That is the tightrope walk of all scientific and financial communication. The simplification necessary for an initial explanation always involves a degree of technical compromise.
You have to lose some of the nuance to make it clear.
However, the goal of an introductory explanation isn't to produce a peer-reviewed academic paper. The goal is to build a functional mental model.
A functional model.
Think about a cartoon map of the subway system. It doesn't show you the geological strata of the earth around the tunnels, but it gets you to your destination perfectly well.
That is a brilliant way to put it. The map isn't the territory, but it works.
The word explained promises a functional map, not a topographical survey.
That makes so much sense. Seeking out explanations, actually seeking out the functional map, is the core of becoming genuinely well-informed.
You have to start somewhere.
As an audience that prides itself on being informed, we have to recognize that consuming raw data points isn't the same as understanding the system. You have to seek out the unpacking of that data.
Which leads us directly to the final and perhaps most structurally vital component of this title.
The audience.
Exactly. To whom is this deeply empathetic, vulnerability-validating, functional map directed? The target audience.
The final phrase of our excerpt identifies the exact persona the author is courting, for beginners.
Index funds explained, for beginners.
The dedication, the perimeter fence.
Let's talk about the human ego, because this phrase fascinates me.
The duality of it, right?
Yeah. I want to look at the duality of labeling something for beginners.
Yeah.
On one level, I understand it's meant to be welcoming.
It's rolling out the welcome mat.
But on another level, doesn't it accidentally highlight the reader's ignorance and potentially bruise their ego before they even turn to page one?
It creates a distinct psychological friction, yes. How do you usually react to that label when you see it?
It really depends on the context, but it usually makes me pause.
It makes me think of the sociology of walking into a commercial gym for the very first time.
Oh, that is such an intimidating environment.
It is incredibly intimidating. You walk onto the main floor. The music is aggressive. There are massive machines with cables and pulleys you don't understand. And people are literally deadlifting small cars.
The loud grunting and the dropping of weights.
Exactly. It's sensory overload. Then you see a smaller, quieter room off to the side.
The safe haven.
It has pastel-colored yoga mats, two-pound dumbbells, and a sign that clearly states, for beginners.
A designated zone of low expectations.
Exactly. On one hand, the relief is palpable. You think, thank goodness I won't get crushed by a barbell in there.
You won't make a fool of yourself.
Right. That is a safe space for me to figure out the basic mechanics of my own limbs without being judged.
But there's a flip side.
But on the other hand, there's this quiet, nagging voice of pride. You don't necessarily want to be seen walking into the beginner room.
You want to look like you belong.
You want to just blend in on the main floor, even if you have absolutely no idea what you're doing. The ego wants the competence without the vulnerability of the learning process.
It is the eternal tension between the desire for the status of competence and the reality of temporary incompetence.
It really is.
But this raises a profound point regarding how we categorize knowledge and how we categorize ourselves.
Yeah.
For beginners, isn't just a gentle welcome mat. It is an incredibly powerful boundary-setting phrase.
I see the idea of a boundary, but it feels like a double-edged sword. You're giving the novice a safe space, sure, but aren't you also putting a ceiling on them?
How do you mean?
You are explicitly telling them, this is the kiddie pool. You aren't swimming in the deep end yet.
I would argue the primary function of the boundary isn't to lock the beginner in.
No.
No, it is to lock the expert out.
Oh, I hadn't thought of it like that.
By explicitly stating who the text is for, it simultaneously and forcefully states who the text is not for. It places a protective shield around the reader.
It keeps the critics away.
It signals to the seasoned financial advisor, the veteran day trader, the person who already understands the nuances of capital gains tax and dividend reinvestment. Keep out. This space is not designed for your level of discourse.
Ah, I see. It's a preemptive strike against the critics.
Exactly.
It's the author saying, don't leave a one-star review complaining that I didn't cover the intricacies of derivative hedging, because the cover clearly states who this is for.
And by keeping the pedantic experts out, it guarantees the reader that the baseline is zero.
You don't need to know anything coming in.
Right. It ensures the pacing of the explanation won't suddenly accelerate and leave the reader behind. Mm. It effectively lowers the institutional barrier to entry that the intimidating phrase index funds erected back at the very beginning of the sentence.
It is a self-contained psychological arc. That's actually a brilliant way to structure a five-word sentence.
It really is elegant when you break it down.
You introduce the stressor, the financial jargon of index funds. You immediately introduce the mechanism for relief. The promise to unpack the box with the word explained.
The bridge over the wall.
And finally, you identify the specific protected beneficiary that relief for beginners. The ego might bristle slightly at the label, but the overwhelming relief of finding a space where ignorance is the expected baseline outweighs the minor hit to one's pride.
And if we step back and look at the broader human experience, isn't it a universal truth that everyone is a beginner at almost everything?
It really is.
As professionals, we get so aggressively siloed in our own narrow domains of expertise.
It's the illusion of universal competence.
The illusion.
Exactly. You might be a genius structural architect who designs skyscrapers, but you are an absolute beginner when it comes to the chemistry of baking bread.
Your skyscrapers might be perfect, but your sourdough is terrible.
Right. You might be a brilliant, board-certified neurosurgeon, but you are a total novice when it comes to fixing a leaky P-trap under your kitchen sink.
Precisely. And true mastery in any field. The ability to eventually leave the pastel room and confidently navigate the main gym floor requires the humility to recognize those gaps.
You have to admit you don't know everything.
It requires the willingness to start with materials explicitly designed for beginners. In Zen Buddhism, there is a concept called Shoshin, which roughly translates to beginner's mind.
Oh, I've heard of that. Beginner's mind.
It refers to maintaining an attitude of complete openness, eagerness, and a deliberate lack of preconceptions when studying a subject, regardless of your actual level of experience.
The beginner's mind. That is so crucial, especially for an audience like ours that actively pursues deep knowledge.
You have to cultivate it intentionally.
Because the moment you convince yourself you aren't a beginner anymore, your brain changes how it processes information.
You stop listening as closely.
You stop absorbing the foundational explanations. You start skimming. You start relying on assumptions based on past patterns rather than engaging with the new material right in front of you.
And assumptions are the absolute enemy of being truly, rigorously well-informed.
They really are. They blind you.
The author of this excerpt is doing something very subtle here. They are not merely targeting people who objectively know nothing about finance.
They are targeting everyone.
They are inviting any reader to actively adopt the posture of a beginner, to consciously empty their cup so that it may be filled with a clear, step-by-step structural explanation.
Empty your cup. That's a great metaphor.
Even a seasoned investor might benefit from revisiting the core philosophy of passive tracking with a beginner's mind.
So as we pull back from the microscope, what does this all mean for you, the listener?
What's the grand takeaway?
We've taken what appeared to be the most frustratingly brief source document imaginable, a solitary 5-word excerpt reading Index Funds Explained for Beginners, and we have spent this deep dive unpacking the complex architecture beneath it.
We've examined how the subject matter, index funds, inherently creates a linguistic and institutional moat, relying on terminology that evokes rigid categorization and high-stakes resources.
Terminology that naturally alienates the uninitiated.
We explore the psychological promise of narrative clarity found in the word explained. We recognize it as a profound act of empathy from the author.
A necessary bridge built over the wall of jargon.
Transforming the mere delivery of raw financial data into a guided, causal journey from confusion to structural understanding.
And we analyzed the empathetic yet complex targeting of the novice with the phrase, for beginners.
The perimeter fence.
We saw how it functions as a boundary setting mechanism, a protective shield that creates a safe harbor for learning by demanding intellectual humility and guaranteeing that no prior knowledge will be assumed.
Navigating the modern world of information, whether you are prepping for a high-stakes meeting, trying to catch up on a new technological paradigm, or just feeding your own insatiable curiosity, often starts right here at the threshold.
It starts before you even open the book.
It starts with deciphering the promises embedded in the titles of the content we consume. You have to look at the marquee and ask yourself, what is this title actually asking of me?
What cognitive load is it promising to alleviate?
And am I willing to embrace the vulnerability of a beginner's mind to actually receive the explanation being offered?
Which brings us to a final lingering philosophical paradox hidden within the very nature of this text.
It's a real catch-22.
If we assume that a book perfectly fulfills the promise of its title, if it flawlessly executes the task of explaining a complex financial system to someone with absolutely no prior knowledge, at what exact moment does the reader cease to be a beginner?
That is the ultimate catch-22 of adult education.
Think about the timeline of the reader's experience. As you read the very first sentence of the explanation, you are actively acquiring knowledge.
You're learning the terminology.
By chapter two, you understand the foundational concepts of market indices.
The fog starts to lift.
By the end of the text, you possess a working, functional mental model of the topic. Therefore, does the very act of reading index funds explained for beginners immediately render the title obsolete for the person holding the book?
You essentially age out of the demographic as you read.
Does the successful transfer of knowledge destroy your own status as a beginner, thereby invalidating the book's premise the moment you finish it?
You destroy the necessity of the book simply by accepting its explanation.